Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. As a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest is Peter Bregman. Peter is the CEO of Bregman Partners, a company that strengthens leadership in people and in organizations. He's also the author of three books, most recently 4 Seconds, All the Time You Need to Stop Counterproductive Habits and Get the Results You Want, which was a top pick by the New York Post in 2015. Another of his books, 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done, won the gold medal from Axiom Business Book Awards and was named the best business book of the year by NPR. Featured on PBS, ABC, and CNN, Peter's articles and commentary appear frequently in publications including Harvard Business Review, Bloomberg Businessweek, Fast Company, Forbes, Psychology Today, The Financial Times, and many more. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really nice to be here with you.
Thank you so much. Peter, I want to start by talking about the role of a trusted advisor. It's so important. Could you share with our listeners who have been some of your mentors along the way and also whether you've mentored others?
You know, there's so many different ways of looking at mentors, you know, and I, as I listened to the question, the first person that came to mind is my daughter, who, you know, has probably trained me more than anyone to be patient, to be, you know, to really think of the outcome that I want, not to react out of, you know, an emotional place, but to be thoughtful. And in some ways, she's, you know, I mean, all my children are really good mentors of mine. My father, my mother, you know, they've all certainly been great mentors. And God, it's such a hard question to answer because I feel like so many people in my life have been guides for me, have been, you know,
right,
wise people that have, you know, my earliest ski coaches who I still work with and I'm still friends with. And my, you know, bosses in my consulting arena when I first started consulting. I mean, I could name a bunch of names that people wouldn't know, but there's so many people that I've learned from and continue to learn from. And I hope that I play that role in people's lives. I mean, I hope that my books are sort of mentorship tools in a sense, you know, that they kind of help us to become smarter, more effective, more productive, more real, wiser people.
I think your books certainly play that role. They have for me anyway. And I love the sound bites approach you take with the books. The chapters are short and succinct, but they carry great wisdom and practical, you know, applicable insights. They're very cleverly titled. You know, they're really nice books, and they're impactful. And I like
what you
said about your kids being you know, mentors as well. Not too many people think about that. But
yeah.
You have two daughters and a son. I've learned a lot about your family from your books. And I love the approach that you take, even in the context of considering yourself a mentor to them. They are to you, you are to them. And this whole thing about not reacting, like when they flood the kitchen or whatever else.
Right.
You know, it's very powerful. So thank you for sharing that. Now,
thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. You began your career, as I understand it, teaching leadership on wilderness and mountaineering expeditions. What are some notable lessons you learned from the wilds that you apply to your practice and business?
One of the things that I liked most about being in the woods was the simplicity of it. You know, literally, you are there with a group of people. Your focus is on surviving to some degree, you know, staying warm, eating, making sure you're not lost. And we could get so much more complicated right now. I mean, with all of our technology and the millions of different things we have to get accomplished. But in reality, you know, the metaphor of, you know, a group of people walking through the woods and making sure that they stay warm and fed and not lost is kind of the same thing we're doing here, except we overcomplicate it. So in some ways, one of the great lessons that I learned in the wilds is to keep it really simple, to not forget that this is about the relationships that I have, and it's about kind of moving from point A to point B in a way that, you know, keeps the group safe.
And I love that, and I also love, as an example, when you fell out in the rapids and you failed, allegedly failed, unquote. And then after that, you realized, well, I survived failure, and you did your little Eskimo roll flips in the kayak or whatever, and you realized, well, see, that was my fear. I faced it. I made it work, so now I can keep moving. And you kind of go on to explain how that works in court, you know, in the business world as well.
Yeah, so it's a huge – that's a – becoming familiar with failure is a wonderful tool to being successful.
And I love the parables that you draw and the analogies between the business world and your wilderness expeditions. And then you moved into the consulting field, Peter, from where you started. How did you make that transition? Was there a steep learning curve?
You know, to some degree. I mean, I started teaching leadership, and even when I was leading expeditions, I was teaching leadership on those expeditions. And then I started my own company teaching leadership using the outdoors as a metaphor, and I worked on a project with a company called the Hay Group, and there was this wonderful woman, Beth Fletcher, who was a mentor of mine, who was running a practice called Hay Alliances, and she invited me to join their practice, and it was a practice that we sort of started all together to make transformational change in organizations. And the work that I was doing fit in as part of the team, and I learned the ropes of consulting and really the depth of how organizations work in that job and under her tutelage and another man named Andy Geller, who was a wonderful mentor of mine. And he ran the Hay Group in New York at the time, and the two of them were the perfect mentoring match to kind of help me understand the business world in the way I wanted to enter it.
And you started Bregman Partners in 98, almost 20 years ago now. What was the biggest challenge you encountered when branching out on your own?
You know, honestly, getting clients. I mean, in the end, it never felt like a huge risk to me. I think it's because some combination of confidence and little to lose. I mean, I was not married at the time. I didn't have kids. I could take some risks. I didn't have a lot of money, but I didn't need, you know, I've never felt strong material needs. And so, you know, I needed the basic stuff, right? Stay warm, move from point A to point B. And I was warm and the biggest challenge was really saying, okay, now I'm just like a guy, and I want clients where I can impact their organizations and impact change. And how do I get the credibility, and how do I get those clients?
Right, right. And by the way, if I might add, I really love, the current book. It's so simple. I just have to say, 4 seconds, it's just the time it takes to pause and not react in the moment is so powerful. Now, you could have called it pause, but I think 4 seconds really, really sums up the essence of what you were trying to convey there, and it's a lot more thought-provoking.
Thank you.
Thank you for putting it out, because it's just one of those things that just hits you over the head like a clunk. It's so obvious, but very few people actually do it.
Yeah, you know, that's sort of like my big secret, which is that I think in most of my books, most of my writing and my speaking, I'm not divulging some big secret that no one has ever thought of before, but hopefully I do it, I write and I speak in a way that helps people take action on it. That ultimately I think that the challenge for all of us is not the great new creative thought that no one else has had before, but the real challenge is closing the gap between what we know and what we actually do. And
yes,
that's where we reap all of the benefits. And so hopefully my writing is to help us do that.
You do a masterful job at it. And one of the things I love about it, Peter, is how you blend so seamlessly relationships in business and in personal, because really we are ourselves wherever we go. And it's the same mindfulness regardless of the setting you're in, whether you're talking to your wife or your spouse or, your colleagues or your boss.
Exactly.
So well done. Now, you advise CEOs and senior leaders in many of the world's premier organizations, including Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Nike, UNICEF, many others. Can you tell us a short story about a particular turning point you may have encountered in getting some of these highly successful leaders to trust you?
Sure. I'll tell you, there's one kind of funny story, which is that it was a large organization and very big organization. It was one of my first clients, and it was potentially a huge project. And they were asking me to come in to help them implement a competency-based performance process. They had actually tried for 2 years, and they couldn't get people to do performance reviews in this organization. And they came in, and they said, look, we really need to know that you understand competencies. Now, I had worked at the Hay Group developing competencies for years. And so I said to them, look, you're asking me the wrong question. Like, I know everything there is to know about competencies. Trust me on this. But you're asking the wrong question, because what you should really be asking me is what I know about managing change in organizations and how to get people to use competencies. Because it's really easy to explain and understand how competencies work, much harder to figure out how to implement them. And that's the problem you're facing, is implementing them. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we still want you to know. We still need to know that you understand competencies, and that's really what we're concerned about. So I said, okay, pull out one of your competency models. Don't show it to me. Just give me the job title that the competency model is for. You know, competency models, they had paid $1 million for these competency models. And I said, pull out a competency model. Don't tell me anything about it. Just tell me the job title. And it was sort of like a mid-level technologist, analyst, something like that. And I said, okay, so you probably have 8 competencies in the model. The first 7 of them are these, and I named 7 competencies I was pretty sure would be in the model. And then the 8th, it might be this one or that one, but I bet it's that one. And sort of they looked up at me in surprise and said, like, oh, my God, you got them all right. I said, how much did you pay for this competency model? $1 million.
And I guess said, you demonstrated competency. It's kind of like a card trick, but still, you pulled it off.
It was just like a card trick. And I basically said, you're spending your money in the wrong place. Like, spending your money developing competencies is the wrong place. Where you should really spend your money, I'll give you the competency models for free. Where you should really spend your money is getting people to use them, because that's how it impacts the organization. It's my whole belief, right, that closing the gap between what we know and what we do is what actually gives us our productivity.
Indeed.
So I got credibility pretty quickly, and that was the project in the end that put us on the map.
Brilliant. I'm sorry. You just brought up my reinforcement of my next question, which was to go back a step and talk about why it's so hard to implement what we know is the right thing to do, that closing the gap of actually taking action. Why is that so different, especially when we're really bright people?
It's a beautiful question, and I think the answer to this question is at the core of what I really care about. Ultimately, we don't do things we should do because of fear of feeling something. That if I know I need to have an uncomfortable, difficult conversation with you, the only reason I don't have it is because I'm afraid of what it will feel like to have it. I'm afraid that I might get rejected, and what will that feel like? Or I'm afraid I might be wrong, and I'll be shamed, or any number of emotions that I am afraid to feel. And as a result, I don't follow through on what I know I should do because I'm afraid of feeling something I don't want to feel. And that ultimately the way we close that gap is by developing what I call emotional courage. And I run a leadership intensive. We spend 4 days really working on this idea of emotional courage, but not sharing the idea. The idea is pretty straightforward, but actually building the courage to feel uncomfortable feelings so that when in real life we're holding back, we're procrastinating on something that's important to us, that we're willing to take that step forward and feel whatever it is. If you are willing to feel everything, then you can do anything. And if there are things that you are not willing to feel because you don't think you can tolerate those feelings, then suddenly you're in a certain kind of prison and you're very limited in your action. So, the short answer is, why do people not follow through is because they don't have the emotional courage necessary to follow through.
Yeah, agreed. And it's just so powerful. Now, why do you think, Peter, that setting goals can actually hurt one's performance?
You know, setting goals is a tricky thing because I don't think that it's always a terrible thing to set goals. But oftentimes we set goals and then we forget why we're setting goals. And I'll give you the positive side of this, which is I was just out at dinner with my cousin, who runs a very successful business. She builds products out of wood. They're carried in a bunch of different places. She's in the UK. And we were talking about sales, and she was saying, you know, people think I'm crazy, but I don't go out and try to, you know, market myself and sell. And she said, part of it is, and she gave an emotional courage issue, right? Part of it is I don't want to, like, put myself out there and then get rejected. I realize that.
Right.
But part of it is that I really want to spend time with my family right now, and they're young kids, and I want to be able to spend time. And so I don't need it to be so successful that it brings me away from, like, what I care most about. That was brilliant on her part, because I can't tell you how many entrepreneurs I know who set a goal that says, I want to grow this business. And if you ask them why they want to grow the business, they say, well, I want to spend time with my family, and I want free time, and I want my own schedule. And then 2 years later, their business is successful, so they've achieved their goal, but the reason behind their goal has failed, right? So they're exhausted, they're overspent, they, you know, have no relationship with their families if they still have families, and they can still look and they say they've achieved their goal. But we become so blindly focused on achieving our goal that we often forget sort of the other elements of why we set that goal in the first place. There's a great story that I share in the book. Ken O'Brien, a former New York Jets quarterback, was throwing too many interceptions. So
right.
He was given what seemed to be a pretty reasonable goal, right? Fewer interceptions thrown. And then he was penalized financially for everyone. And it worked. He threw fewer interceptions, but only because he threw fewer passes.
Ah.
So his overall performance suffered, even though he achieved the goal. And
correct.
I could tell you story after story after story. So the problem with setting goals is that we may achieve them, but we may achieve them at the expense of what's really important to us. And we have to keep what's really important to us in mind in order not to let the goals take over.
And so the alternative to setting goals is?
I think of it as setting areas of focus. So I think, you know, this is something I want to spend my time on. This is something I care about and I want to spend my time on. And I'm not going to set, you know, some goal that may distract me from what's really important to myself. I'm just going to say, you know, I'm going to focus on certain things. And then if I continue to focus on these things effectively, I'll achieve the ultimate goals that I have.
Brilliant. I love it. So it's focus, keeping the focus of what's most important in mind as opposed to the goal in and of itself.
Exactly.
Yes. Now, we go to one other relevant node here, spokes on the wheel. How did true leaders go about holding someone accountable or, in some cases, changing somebody's mind?
You know, it's very interesting. I mean, I would say it's so counterintuitive. And that's the point of this book in many ways, is that our intuitive knee-jerk reactions often work against us.
Correct.
Right? And so this is very counterintuitive, but if you really want to change someone's mind, your best bet at doing that is to listen to them. So most of us think, well, if I want to change someone's mind, I've got to argue with them. But the reality is arguing only further entrenches someone in their own position. If you really want to change their mind, listen to them. First of all, you may learn something, which wouldn't be half bad, right? You may actually, you know, gain some knowledge here. But the other thing is that when you listen to them and they feel heard, they soften. And when they soften, they will be more willing to listen to you. So it's if you really want to hold someone accountable, figure out what's going on for them instead of just jumping into what's going on for you, and you'll have a much better rate of success.
Absolutely critical. But it does take that 4 seconds to pause and, instead of reacting, remind yourself to remember to take what's important to the other person into account first and foremost. That will give you the emotional courage, in your words, to listen to them and, as you say, come up with some insights that may allow the whole thing to shift. And kind of along those lines, I love how you say that people should be accountable and take blame, take responsibility, because in a similar way, that diffuses the situation and softens people and, you know, you can
own everything we can possibly own, right?
Yes.
Because if we shift blame to other people, that's when we get ourselves in trouble and when we create an environment in which everyone's trying to avoid blame.
Correct. And, of course, that's the antithesis of leadership, true leadership. Now, you believe
exactly.
that everyone has the capacity to lead. So what is it that keeps
For sure.
most people from stepping into that role? Why don't more people step in?
You know, my feeling around that is that the reason people don't is, again, the emotional courage piece. That ultimately we can all step in. But in order to step in order to lead, what you need to do is be willing to risk other people looking at you in a certain way, because leadership, by definition, is moving in a different direction than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And when you move in a different direction than everybody else, then that's going to feel risky to you. You're going to be in this limbic space. You don't have followers yet, but you're stepping out and you're disagreeing with other people and you're moving in a different direction. You're shifting from the status quo. By definition, that's uncomfortable. So what do you need? You need that emotional courage. And it's why, you know, emotional courage is the main thing we focus on in the Leadership Intensive, because ultimately I could share all sorts of great, brilliant ideas in the Leadership Intensive, but none of them is going to actually change how you move through the world as a leader, sort of ambitiously achieving the things that you want to achieve. You get that by building up your emotional courage.
Well, and I'm sure you'll pivot off of, I'm sure you're aware of, Peter, Simon Sinek's whole premise of the golden circle. Are
the
you aware?
Why, coming back to the why?
Exactly, exactly. It kind of pivots in that direction for me when we're having this conversation. People don't buy how you do what you do. They buy your why, the emotional
right.
why. So this notion of emotional intimacy and courage, it comes down to stepping in and behaving in a way that encourages others to soften and know that they're being heard and acknowledged in
yep.
any kind of relationship.
I think that's absolutely right.
So what's one piece of specific advice you would have for our listeners who want to begin developing their own innate leadership capacity?
I would say take risks. Make yourself uncomfortable. Continue to do things you're not entirely sure that you can succeed at. And then when you succeed, feel what that feels like. And when you fail, feel what that feels like also. That allow every experience you have to be evaluated based on your capacity to feel it versus your capacity to either succeed or fail in it. That ultimately life is about having a variety of different emotional experiences and embrace them all. And when you do that, you can't possibly fail because everything makes you feel something.
And your relationships of all stripes, personal and professional, will be that much richer and more fulfilling for it.
Agreed.
So, you know, before we wind up our chat, and I'm very aware of your time constraints, Peter, I would like to ask you the most important question I like to try to ask every guest at the conclusion of our time together. And effectively, that's what comes next for you. What's the one project or collaboration you've not yet started or you might be on the beginning of that you dream about creating as part of your legacy? You've already created a great legacy as it is, but...
You know, there's a couple of things. I mean, my next book I'm really excited about. My next book takes 4 seconds one step farther around this emotional courage issue, and I'm going to really be playing with
these emotional
courage issues.
I was hoping you'd say that because emotional courage is really at the heart of what you're trying to create here.
Exactly, and it's almost like 18 minutes was the first step. You know, 18 minutes was really a focus on what you do with your time, and 4 seconds is very much about how you do it, right? Like if you like what you do with your time might be I have to have a difficult conversation. 4 seconds is about how you do that effectively, and then emotional courage is very much about how do we get ourselves to a place where we could actually follow through effectively in these things when they are most difficult for us. So that I'm really excited about. And also, you know, with Bregman Partners, my company, I am really moving we're expanding it in certain ways. And that's very exciting to me, both in terms of bringing in more coaches and consultants and really having a community of coaches and consultants, and also the way that we can impact organizations if we spread this out farther. So I'm very excited about, you know, both of those things are really the things that excite me the most.
I love that in both directions. And honestly, in the context of legacy, this is, you could create a life's work and just distill the essence of it into exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it, Peter. And
oh,
people get, you know, build this habit, this muscle around emotional courage as they would, you know, take care of their bodies when they're working out, boy, life would be a lot easier for a lot of people. So
I agree with you.
Thank you.
And by the way, I should say that I don't approach any of this as a guru from on up high who descends his heavenly perch to share his great wisdom and then come down. Like, I struggle with all of this stuff. I'm building my own emotional courage. I'm learning to pause for my 4 seconds and take a deep breath and not react, you know, and that's one of the things that my children are my mentors for. And I really work hard on all of these things. I don't think it comes easy. It's why I write about them.
No, and I really have to applaud you one final time for telling your own stories by way of example, because a lot of people wouldn't do that. It's vulnerable. It demonstrates your own emotional courage, and it really brings home the points you're trying to make and demonstrates that you are, in fact, one of the rest of us. You're not somebody on high. So, you know, thank you for being as human and authentic as you are.
No, you're welcome. It's the only way I know how to be.
Exactly.
Otherwise,
right.
There'd be way too much pressure.
And it is a model for others. So, again, it encourages people. Thank you for taking the time with us today, Peter. I realize we had limited time, but I really appreciated the insights you shared. And I wish you all the best in this next phase of where you're headed.
My great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and as usual, I want to thank my show producers and my listeners. We'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.